coming to you from the West Coast, this is Politicoast. Today is May 18th, 2018, and this is episode 86. Politicoast is your weekly politics recap with a West Coast perspective. If you haven't already, make sure to subscribe and leave a review wherever you found us. And really, leave us a review. I just noticed the other podcast, Can Be Report, has just overtaken Politicoast, which is a bit embarrassing since it's a newer podcast with fewer listeners. So if you could go onto your computer, download iTunes, create an account, and leave us a five-star review, write something nice, tell us a joke. At some point, we'll probably get a prize for that to make it happen. But screen cap and send us your reviews and tell us that you're doing it because we need those reviews. Also, go on Facebook. Maybe leave us a review there. Go on Twitter, where we're at Politicoast Pod. Tweet at us. Tell us that you like us. We need your validation. And if you really want to do something great, go and support us at patreon.com/politicoast, where you can give us money, and then we can get to hosting live shows and pub nights and doing things like that.
I'm Scott Belembu.
And I'm Ian Bushfield. On today's show, we're going to talk about the stupid emails, and we're going to talk about the stupid pipeline. First, of course, we have to thank our premier sponsors, Lindsay Tedds and Blake Hodson, for helping make the show possible. And we have to tell you about our partner, BC Today, British Columbia's brand new daily newsletter dedicated exclusively to BC politics. Sign up for your free trial to get that unique coverage of the BC legislature delivered to your inbox every morning. Listeners to Politicoast receive 25% off your subscription when you enter the offer code Politicoast, all lowercase. For your free two-week trial of the newsletter, go to britishcolumbiatoday.ca. For the first segment, but the emails. So this is less bad than the Hillary Clinton email scandal, at least. But it seems to be the thing the BC Liberals have been obsessed with for the last week and a half. Do we care?
At this point, probably not that much, but this has the potential to get worse, I think.
I don't know that it does. I think we're almost like past it. And if we were recording in 2 days, it might already be over. But let's rewind a week. So what started this all off is it turns out Citizen Services Minister Ginny Sims was shown to have been using her personal email account to contact the Premier's staff, her deputy minister, people in the Premier's office. And this is not a great look since she's the one in charge of the Freedom of Information request file, and you can't FOI someone's personal email account.
Also not a great look because the BC NDP made a big stink about the Liberals when they were messing around with emails.
Yeah, Sims' defense was that she was using her iPad and just hitting that share button to send articles on Twitter to her staff and others who were like, oh, hey, follow up on this. And she just didn't know how to set up her government email on her iPad or something like that. She apologized last Thursday and has basically said she's not doing that anymore, which is good. But at the same time, the Liberals came out with a string of Freedom of Information requests, or at least they wanted to, but it turns out they had no results. They FOI'd a bunch of the senior staff in the Premier's office to try to find out, I guess, what was happening and what they were telling each other in the first 100 days of office. This is the kind of thing your opposition researchers do, and it doesn't usually churn up much. But it usually turns up something because people send emails. Turns out they had been sending emails, but they just were deleting them, which is not a great look when you, again, followed the party that you accused of being the triple delete party. So you had five senior people in the Premier's office, all with a whole bunch of missing emails, and then two more came out later. And they also found that Advanced Education Minister Melanie Mark was missing emails for the entire month of February. Also a bad look. The Premier's office responded quickly to say that no official policies were violated, but these emails shouldn't probably have been deleted, and this isn't really best practice.
If you have to go with the it's not technically illegal argument, you're pretty much losing.
Well, and I think this is one of the things the BC NDP was pointing out when they were in opposition, is that our FOI laws are actually pretty crappy, and there is a exemption in there that says ministers and staff and all of these people can delete, quote, transitory emails, which are ones deemed not that important. So you should have the meeting, you should have a record of the email that you're scheduling a meeting, but you don't need the record that, I don't know, you book childcare maybe for that one period of time. But this is a vague law, and when there's vagaries, mistakes happen.
Or abuses.
And abuses. So the premier also tried to say that most of these emails still exist on some server somewhere, so they can be found. But it also turns out that we haven't given the FOI office the power to go into that server because it's very hard and expensive.
Which seems weird. Like, I'm not sure the technical side behind this, but pulling data from a server isn't the sort of thing that should be massively expensive.
I don't know how it's technically set up. It's dumb as well, and it's one of those things where the government has definitely fucked up and should probably be owning that. Today, Horgan did apologize to the legislature, saying, yeah, we had some naive staff kind of thing at the start, and that's sort of to be expected. Training didn't happen right away. It's been followed up now, and it seems like the abuses aren't ongoing, which is at least an improvement.
Yeah, but still, you know, not deleting government emails is kind of one of those things that if you don't know going into the job, you should have at least picked up from every other email scandal that's ever happened and just be aware of it through cultural osmosis.
Especially when your party has criticized it.
The ignorance thing doesn't play too well here, I think.
I will stand by this is probably going to be blowing over sooner unless there's something else to come out. Because realistically, if the government is starting to follow the policies and their staffers are properly maintaining records and the how do we government has trickled down through all of the elements of staff and they're putting best practices in place, there's not much more you can criticize them for or ask them to do. You can be like, that was really bad. And they go, yes, it was. We're sorry. We're doing better now. If it turns out they're still deleting emails, that's a problem. And I think that's where the difference with the liberals came up, is they kind of never really acknowledged it was bad for months on end. And this took about a week.
Yeah, it might blow over, but yeah, if the Liberals did have, I think, one more email thing, it has the potential to blow up in the NDP's face.
I guess it plays a little bit in the same way that the libel lawsuit with the former bureaucrat, when they fired him and then slandered him and then went, oh shit, we're a little bit rushed on that. It's like growing pains for a new government, that it's not that they should get a pass. It's that you can see why it happens, and if it keeps happening, it's the issue.
Yeah, and that's maybe okay in the first month or two, even if maybe we shouldn't be cutting them as much slack as some people are, but Melanie Mart's emails, they were in February, and by that point, they'd been in government for over half a year, and there's really not much of an excuse at that point.
Yeah, her technical excuse was, oh, it was my deputy minister's job to log emails, not mine, so I just wasn't doing it properly. She followed up by saying, I shouldn't have said that, and I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's not a good thing to throw your staff under the bus. Like,
it happens all the time in politics, though.
Yeah. And B, you know, ultimately the minister is responsible, and the butt stops with her on that one.
So this was basically the line of questioning for the BC Liberals for the last 2 weeks, and it shows one of the techniques that opposition can use to get a message across. The BC Greens, I think, for how good it is, are using their question period chances to ask key questions about issues they care about and trying to like move specifics. But the Liberals are taking the other strategy, which is let's obsess on one issue and just fire talking points back and forth until people start paying attention, which I guess is why we're talking about it. It's maybe not a way to show that you're a government in waiting.
It's a little scorched earth, but can be quite effective.
And the NDP probably did it just as much. And it's And it's something that happens at federal parliament, but it's just interesting, I think, the different tactics and strategies that they're taking on. And this is maybe one of the first major issues that Andrew Wilkinson has moved the needle a little bit. I don't know how much it's penetrated beyond, you know, the pundit class.
The ethics ones can be tricky that way because you can have popular policies that the NDP put in, and so far they've more or less been on the right side of public opinion for that. But yeah, when you start hitting the ethical stuff, it can kind of undermine the general confidence, and you can get some traction that way as the opposition.
And I think it has to come with the narrative, though, at first. Like, the Liberals suffered this a lot because they'd been in power for long enough and there was this air of corruption, justly or not, around them.
Freudian slip there.
And so the attacks on the ethics of the BC Liberals built up a narrative. It's something the Liberals are trying to build up, but I think at this point, it's still really early to try to paint the BC NDP as horribly inept and corrupt. But
gotta start somewhere.
Yeah, we'll come back to this in a year, and if we're still talking about emails. And I keep joking, but Trump really ruined the ability to talk in any nuance about email policies. Like, this is a legitimate issue, but I can't take it seriously because I just keep thinking, emails.
Yeah, well, if it wasn't your party, you'd probably feel the opposite way.
Do you care?
I have some minor concerns about this. Like, it isn't the, oh, this is ridiculous because emails that you seem to be kind of in the mood for, or that's your headspace right now.
It's bad. Like, they shouldn't have deleted the things. They've apologized and are trying to do better, so I don't know what more we can ask at this point. Should someone lose their job? Maybe. Maybe that's what we're waiting for. Who's going to do that? But Don Wright, the deputy chief of staff, I believe, is conducting investigations into all the staff who've been shown to have missing emails. And when that report comes out, well, if it comes out, when he's done his investigation, I guess we'll see if any heads roll. But otherwise, I don't think there's much traction beyond this week unless it's an ongoing systemic problem in this government, in which case, yeah, it's definitely an issue.
Moving on to segment two, pipeline stuff again. Kinder Morgan remains in the news, and once again, we're talking about it, as Ottawa this week announced that they're going to be putting some money on the table, potentially, that if the pipeline gets delayed and ends up costing Kinder Morgan some money. So they've offered to indemnify Kinder Morgan against any delays from the battle between political jurisdictions in Canada. So if this whole little spat ends up costing Kinder Morgan some money, the Canadian taxpayers are going to be on the hook for it.
Morneau put a lot of political capital on pointing fingers at BC, saying, you know, the BC government's delaying this pipeline. If BC delays it through the courts, then the federal government will backstop the legal costs for Kinder Morgan, essentially. Which, so far, BC hasn't actually done much to delay it. We're filing a constitutional reference question, but there's no injunction tied to that yet. There are some moves by Burnaby, I believe, but that court case is already done. There's a few First Nations challenges, but the federal government here was talking about BC. So it still feels like a lot of rhetoric to me. Like, here we have the British Columbia government talking that, yes, they're using every tool in the toolbox to stop it, but realistically, they haven't slowed it down any more than if they had done nothing. Rhetoric matters, I guess, but mostly it's Kinder Morgan going, we don't know if this is profitable and we don't want to deal with this, whatever the hell's going on in Canada. And here's Morneau trying to, in a way, provide assurances to Kinder Morgan without, I don't know how much they'd ever have to be on the hook for.
Yeah, the article isn't particularly clear on exactly how much they'd be on the hook for. In fact, Morneau hasn't publicly said how much we'd potentially be on the hook for. But yeah, it's not just the court costs. I believe it's the project costs that if there's a delay from the courts, which can be more significant, although court battles aren't cheap either. So yeah, like, we could be looking at tens of millions of dollars at a minimum if there's any sorts of delays in this new policy kicks in.
Well, and Morneau's not talking about if protesters delay it or some other issues.
The government.
Delay. Yeah.
They're talking government about actions to it.
So it's a move that hasn't actually inspired much confidence in Kinder Morgan, or at least that's what their CEO seems to be saying, is, well, this is nice, but we still don't feel like we have the confidence to go forward, get on things before May 31st.
Yeah, and the issue, I suspect, from Kinder Morgan's side isn't the, well, what does the cost over the next 6 months look like? It's the, does this actually make sense on the long term? And as far as I can tell, this proposal doesn't actually go that far to cover the, well, if we just have to cancel the thing, how much are we going to have to eat?
So here's where Morneau's proposal gets a little bit more interesting, is they don't actually specify that they are, they specify that they'll indemnify Kinder Morgan, but they'll also cover anyone else who wants to run ahead with this pipeline, whether another company steps in or maybe a government buys a stake in it. And this is putting the ball maybe to Rachel Notley and the Alberta NDP to say, hey, if you want to invest in that, maybe that's your thing to do. And it doesn't look at the moment like the federal government's ready to pony up money for this. So maybe it's up to the Alberta taxpayers to fund this project that the free market can't decide whether it's worthwhile.
The Liberals really want to get this thing built. They've staked a huge amount of political capital on it. But it would also look really bad if they actually have to cut a big check to get it built. And yeah, I can see why Ottawa's looking to get someone else to pony up some money, whether it's another pipeline company, whether it's the government of Alberta, whether it's Jason Kenney's government of Alberta in a year or whatever when he gets, or when he's likely to be elected. It's going to be interesting to see how that plays out, but I don't think anyone actually wants to put billions of dollars of taxpayer money into this. They can help it.
Kinder Morgan doesn't even seem to want to put private money into this at this point. Even just the amount, the unspecified but smaller amount that Morneau has sort of put on the line to indemnify against these legal risks, that's already drawn the ire of Andrew Scheer's Conservatives, saying the government shouldn't really be on the hook for this private project.
Which is a surprisingly free market position for him to take with the oil industry.
It's not dairy. He's fine with the oil industry being a bit more free market, maybe. And Jagmeet Singh as well took a stronger position, and really the first position we've seen him take on Kinder Morgan since he finally made a decision about pipelines in the middle of his leadership campaign. But he tweeted out that the Liberals are giving Texas oil company hashtag Kinder Morgan a blank check while dumping all the risks on Canadians. It's clear this pipeline should not be built. And then the rest of his caucus talked about how they're starting to build a better strategy on how they're going to talk about the pipeline, because so far their strategy has just been to not talk about the pipeline, other than to say there should be a process.
Closer to home, Andrew Wilkinson's lashed out at the BC government over this, criticizing the NDP for making Canadian taxpayers have to pick up the tab for their shenanigans.
I can't take him too seriously on this file. Like, it's not the BC government's fault that Trudeau and Morneau are putting up money here. That's sort of a blame the victim situation, where the federal government is a free independent actor in this. They can put money or not put money to something if they want.
Yeah, it's not a great line of attack, but that's the one he's going with.
Like, I get that the BC Liberals are in favor of this, although ironically, they had a set of conditions under Christy Clark that they said had to be met, which were pretty flexible, I think. And now Horgan has basically just said no project will meet the conditions, which are just a bit higher, because he's basically framed it more around the environmental spill regulations, which is what we're going into this constitutional reference case over. It's really been a blustery week. On the other side of the border here, we had the Alberta government pass third reading Bill 12, which is the turn off the taps bill, as it's been called. It actually allows Alberta to restrict the flow of oil out of its province by any means. So they might not ship us to us by rail, truck, or pipeline. And that hasn't received royal assent yet, but Rachel Notley has said maybe, probably, definitely, at some point this bill will be used, but it'll be a surprise when. And David Eby has said as soon as it receives royal assent and becomes a law, he's filing constitutional challenge in that province. Because you see, we should have the right in BC to tell other provinces they can't give us oil, but other provinces shouldn't have the right to not give us oil.
Isn't federalism fun?
This was pointed out, well, I think by Rob Shaw on Twitter.
Everyone's pointed out the fact that everyone's kind of playing a little fast and loose with what provinces should be able to do in what circumstances.
Well, we talked about Scott Moe's arguments that Saskatchewan's bringing forward to the reference case that are exactly opposite the arguments they brought to the Como beer case. What provinces should be able to do is entirely dependent on what province wants to do what. If another province wants to restrict you, then you're going to get upset. But if you want to restrict it to me, you're going to be happy with that. So it's all very logical and consistent. I don't know which of these laws is going to be constitutional. Seems like a crapshoot this time. If Rachel Notley does turn off the taps, it looks like that will turn our $1.60 gas prices into $2 plus gas prices, and we're going to have a very interesting summer. Andrew Wilkinson is already calling on John Horgan to take radical steps to lower gas prices, like cutting back the carbon tax that the BC Liberals introduced, or some of the other taxes on the fuel.
Does it make sense to cut a carbon tax? Because the whole point of a carbon tax is to have a carbon tax to discourage excess fuel use.
It's a silly week. I don't have much else to say on this pipeline other than...
Keeps going.
Yeah.
And we're not out of this yet.
Well, the debate keeps going. The construction has not, though. I guess the last thing to say on the pipeline is we mentioned protesters, and one of the most famous protesters was Kennedy Stewart, now mayoral hopeful in the city of Vancouver. He pled guilty to his charge of breaking the injunction on protesting at a very specific spot around the pipeline construction. And it's a criminal charge, but he will face a $500 fine, I think, serve no time in jail. And I don't think he gets a criminal record. So it's mostly just a slap on the wrist. $500 isn't nothing, but it's like a bad speeding ticket.
If he's made a fair bit of money, it's probably won't be that noticeable.
And he's gotten enough press for it that in a positive way to the people he wants to appeal to, and he can kind of wear it as a badge of honor now. So he fought the law, and the law sort of won. Moving on to quick takes. Site C is back in the news, speaking of big energy projects that won't go away. There is this lawsuit filed by the West Moberly and Profit River First Nations saying that the construction by BC Hydro of this dam that will flood a portion of their land infringes their Aboriginal rights to the unceded territory there. That was filed in January, and BC Hydro is going to say, no, we've consulted all of this. The federal government announced this last week that they have no opinion about this. They, as a government, have spoken out in favor of Site C and said it passes environmental standards, but they're just weirdly taking no position at all on the Aboriginal title versus energy project, which I think confused everyone.
Yeah, it's a interesting thing for the government just to take a hands-off approach. Maybe they didn't want to be fighting about more than one big energy project in BC. It's a little hard to say. I don't think the federal government's really given any reasons for its decision.
The federal government has talked in the past about their somewhat in favor of this project, but they also are saying more that it's a BC provincial jurisdiction much more clearly than anything else, because it is built in BC to serve energy needs and owned by the province. So there's some like environmental stuff that touches on federal regulations, but
by and large, it's a BC jurisdictional matter, whereas Kinder Morgan isn't.
Except for the Aboriginal issue, where Aboriginal rights should be on a nation with Canada. But, you know, the First Nations were confusingly, I think, pleased with this move. They probably would have preferred Jody Wilson-Raybould as Attorney General to side with them, but I guess the federal government not opposing them is good for them. I think this was also just on the question of whether there should be an injunction on work. So should the project be delayed while we sort out this Aboriginal title? And that question could tie up the project for months, years, and cost BC Hydro a lot more, which I'm sure the Greens would tell us makes it an even less good project to build because it was already on the line. But yeah, interesting twist to the ongoing Site C legal battles, and we'll see where that case goes.
Well, moving on to another big file that the BC government's dealing with, ICBC has announced they want to do some rate changes. David Eby, whose mandate includes ICBC,
among everything else,
has released the results of one of the many, many consultations the government was running. This one had 35,000 people, which is a respectable number. And interestingly, 82% of them said that risky drivers should pay more, which makes sense.
No one considers himself a risky driver. So this is one of those statements where it's like, should bad people be punished for doing bad things? Yes.
As a result, ICBC's looking at more or less putting those into effect. So it would be a 20% rate increase for anyone with one or more driving-related criminal code convictions, one or more 10-point Motor Vehicle Act convictions, one or more excessive speeding, or two or more roadside suspensions or prohibitions.
So I was one of the 35,000 people who took this survey because this is what I do in my spare time, besides podcasting and actually working. And I remember a lot of the questions in it were asking how you feel about like certain levels. Like, would a 20% rate increase be too much, or would a 30, and it gave you different levels. And it seems like a lot of people were happy with, let's go 20% higher on people who get convictions or otherwise penalized, which is fairly substantial rate increase. But this is how you can make it affordable to then reward safer drivers. The theory, I guess, being that if you pay more, you will have a deterrent from driving badly. And if you drive well, you will get rewarded. Carrot and stick approach hopefully will work. I mean, it's got to go along with a lot of other things because deterrence doesn't always work because people aren't very rational. But on the specific rate increases, I saw in this article we're looking at, Paul Dobroshenko, I believe is his name, the lawyer who's talking about some of the concerns he has with this. And I think these go back to some of the things we spoke with Kyla Lee a few weeks ago about with the roadside prohibition regime, which is kind of problematic, let's say, and go back and listen to that whole episode. But in essence, part of the problem here is people who get pulled over on the roadside and get this ticket won't necessarily realize right away that you're not just paying the $200 or whatever they bill you right there, or that comes in the mail, but you're also going to be facing a big increase next year. So you're kind of having like hidden knock-on effects. Maybe the government just needs to advertise that you shouldn't drive impaired or otherwise. But as Kyla pointed out, the appeals process that if you're innocent is kind of reversed in that situation. And so this could result in a lot more...
For the roadside suspensions. Yes. I believe the excessive speeding would be a pretty standard traffic court.
Yeah. But in all these cases, you could be looking at a lot more appeals and people fighting their tickets, which further backlogs an already overburdened court system. It's kind of an inevitable issue that any fix is going to create two new problems, but ICBC is facing a massive deficit, and if we don't do something, we will not have insurance. So,
which would be bad.
Or we will all face a 200% rate increase or something ridiculous. So
yeah, and putting it more on the bad drivers does make a certain amount of sense.
Yeah. So these have to go forward from here. I don't know if they need to put them into a new law or otherwise, but it sounds like they can do some of the easy changes this fall quickly, but they want to get most of the changes in by next spring.
I believe it has to go before the Utilities Commission. There's a independent review board. I think it's the Utilities Commission. This has to go through to the ICBC falls under that, I think.
The other one interesting thing that I did see that was interesting in these proposals was right now insurance is tied to vehicles, and they're thinking about changing it so it's actually tied to the driver. And that proposal was pretty popular. And that makes all kinds of sense because it's bad drivers that cause accidents mostly, not this chunk of metal and electronics.
Yeah, largely made sense. The only little thing I could see that might throw a slight wrench in it is the, very expensive cars or what. You might get some difference in payouts there, but that difference there has got to be smaller than quality of driver.
And there's probably a way to offset that and match those kind of things. You'd also need to find a way to do secondary drivers and things like that. But there's going to be lots more creative ideas. It doesn't sound like we're going to a fully no-fault system, because that's complicated and people get scared about that. But hopefully some of this fixes the problem. Well, Andrew Weaver's private members bill on benefit corporations that we talked about a couple weeks ago, the first bill drafted with the new legislative drafting office's help, has actually moved and passed second reading and is going to committee. And, well, lots of bills do this. Almost all of those bills for the entire history of this province have been government bills, and this is one of the first private members' bills from an opposition member to go forward potentially ever. In the last couple of weeks, people have managed to go through and try to dig up every actual private members' bill that has been passed into law in the last 30 years. All that anyone seems to be able to find are a couple bills from government backbenchers, like the Terry Fox Day Act, which I think I mentioned is 8 words in total, or there was the one complementary medicine bill in 2002 or something like that. But it also came from a backbencher on the government side. So this is the first private members' bills to move another step towards becoming law. And it should be studied by committee this fall. So we're all cheering for this bill because it seems reasonable. And it's cool to see private members' motions actually do something.
Yeah, it's not a great sign for democracy, in fact, that there are so few private members' bills that ever pass.
It really highlights a weakness of the BC political system specifically. At the federal level, private members' bills don't tend to go very far, but some have become law, and some get through the whole system, or get most of the way. But yeah, BC really gives the government a lot of power to just stall everyone else's proposals on the order paper. So let's hope this bill goes a little bit further and we'll keep following it. And again, if you know anything about benefit corporations and want to make the argument for them, send us a message and we'll get you on the show to actually explain it more than just what we've read in Andrew Weaver's press releases. Well, and finally, one thing we didn't mention last week, I think it was happening right as we were about to record, but there was a March for Life rally at the BC legislature, and this is the pro-lifers, anti-choicers, the people who really don't like abortion. They also don't tend to like contraceptives either. They had their rally, and in attendance, I think even speaking, were two MLAs, Lori Thronis and former interim Liberal leader Rich Coleman, both BC Liberals, were there and spoke out in favor of this rally. And it's a bit embarrassing for the party. BC, I think, has a pretty strong plurality, a pretty strong majority in support of abortion rights. But there is still a social conservative bent, even within the broad BC Liberal tent. And one thing someone asked us on Twitter, and this is why I bring it up, because it was kind of almost a non-story, is does this mark a difference in Andrew Wilkinson's leadership versus Christy Clark, where she was, I think, pretty good at keeping the social conservatives quiet, let's say.
That very well could be. Both of them are federal liberals and from that wing of the party. So I don't think it reveals much about kind of Andrew Wilkinson's leanings, but it might indicate something about kind of the grip on caucus he has and whether or not he's as effective at keeping that sort of thing on the down low, rather than getting spilled out into a public demonstration on the lawn of the legislature.
Yeah, it made a splash for a day in the media, or in people who are watching for it. These aren't MLAs who are going to be bringing forward petitions or private members' bills to restrict, you know, abortion rights within hospitals in BC. Say we're going to defund it and make it really difficult. Wilkinson, as we were talking about with Jillian last week, has made an effort to make sure that women are well represented in his staff. He's committed to having a gender balanced cabinet if he becomes premier, which is something you don't usually see politicians on the center right do. So, you know, he's playing up sort of feminist bona fides. And if, I mean, you know, it could be the sort of feminist branding that Trudeau does, which sometimes doesn't always reflect actual policy, but it doesn't fit the brand to be running around with pro-lifers in your caucus. So, oh, it'll be interesting to watch that dynamic. And maybe, like you say, this is just a little bit less control, but maybe a little bit more pro-free expression, and we could have some bozo eruptions, which are always fun.
We have no best of BC Poly this week. However, if you do have something, please send it our way. Tate it with the hashtag best of BC Poly. We'll be checking that every week. And, you know, also tate our podcast account on Twitter at PolitosPod. So we definitely will see it that way.
We tend not to take the partisan snipes.
Yes.
We look for things that are just like happy and.
Yeah, we did get one rather partisan one that got tagged with it this week, but as you said, we don't really want this just to be the, oh, look at the zinger this politician said against the other party.
Elevate hashtag BC Poly, not devolve into the partisan snipes that we know it is.
And that has been Politos. Find links to the stories we mentioned in the show notes at politos.ca. Make sure to subscribe or listen to podcasts and follow us on Facebook and Twitter at PolitosPod. Leave us a review and let us know what you think. Support the show and get early access to our interviews at patreon.com/politost. And if you have ideas for the show, feel free to send them to us. Thanks for listening.